Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. About 6 weeks ago today, I had a little pain in my chest, the kind millions of Americans have felt over the years. Set me off on a big adventure, a little trip to the doctor just to check it out, an ambulance ride to the hospital when he heard my story, and 6 weeks ago today, my chest sawed open for heart bypass surgery that let me dodge a bullet that some Americans dodge and some do not. Coronary heart disease is this country's number one killer. After a holiday season of eggnog and cookie platters, you may be thinking about it yourself. Today, we've brought in the medical team that brought me through, in part to thank them, but really to hear the big story of heart disease and heart health in this country today, this hour On Point, the real heart of the matter. Before I introduce my guest, I want to just take a second to express my very deep gratitude to you, so many listeners, for all the support I received in my surgery and recovery time. Your unbelievable mountain of calls and letters and emails really touched me and helped me pull through, and I'm very grateful for it. It was very moving, and I really do thank you. And now, to a big part of the wonderful gang who, by my lights, just saved my life. If you put it all together, there were dozens who helped, but we've got the heart of the team with us today, people to whom I am really grateful and indebted. Three right here in the studio and another joining us from the hospital where I had my surgery. Let me introduce to you first, Nahum Vishnevsky, my primary care physician for what, nearly 20 years now, Nahum?
1989
at Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates in Wellesley, Massachusetts, the guy that set me on my way to get this all fixed, and thank heavens he did. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Vishnevsky.
Thanks, Tom.
Also, Rodney Falk, my cardiologist with Harvard Vanguard, who also teaches at Harvard Medical School and Boston University. He was there in the emergency room when I arrived and picked this case up right away and followed it through so very well, and I'm so grateful. Dr. Rodney Falk, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And last but by no means least, on the doctor front, Prem Shekhar is here, cardiac surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and assistant professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, the man who put me under the knife, who did all the work. They call him the natural down there at the hospital, and I felt very confident and comfortable as a person can be with heart surgery going on. Dr. Shekhar, thank you very much for bringing me through, and thank you for being here today.
It's my pleasure, Tom, and thanks for having me.
And with us from Brigham and Women's Hospital, there were so many, that is in Boston, so many who helped me through there, but I wanted to at least have a representative, because it's not all done when the doctors sing here, is cardiac nurse Michelle DePreet. She was right there in those days immediately after the surgery, just one of so many who were so important, and I really had little idea because it had been a long time since I was in the hospital, just how important that part of the process is. Michelle, you were great in the hospital. I'm so grateful to you. I don't know about the way those tubes got pulled out. You got my attention in a hurry, but Michelle, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Okay, we're going to tell a little bit of a personal story here today, but it's really a national and, in a sense, a global story, because heart disease is such a big issue still, despite all the awareness of it, and so many millions of Americans and others go through it. I want to just begin to dive in. I mean, just to set the table a little bit, this story kind of begins. It was 6 weeks ago today that the surgery took place, a couple of days before that I went out to see my primary care physician. I had had just an unfamiliar tightness in the middle of my chest for, I don't know, 3-4 weeks off and on before I went in on that day. I didn't have high blood pressure. I'd been on Lipitor for the better part of a decade. I didn't have really high cholesterol. Everybody carries a couple extra pounds, but I wasn't really significantly overweight. And yet, there was that tightness. I wasn't feeling quite right. Dr. Nahum Vishnevsky, I ended up sitting with you, telling you my story, and you said to me, leave your car in the parking lot, you're going to the hospital. Why? How did you know to say that?
Well, it's the story you told. I think we have to go back a few more steps. When you first called, the phone secretary when she hurts chest pain, she wasn't going to make any decisions. So she transferred you to the nurses. The nurses were on lunch, so Patty Moran, who's a nurse practitioner, who's been my partner for 24 years, took your call. She listened to your story, and she realized something wasn't right. So she interrupted me. She said, I have this fellow, Tom Ashbrook. He's telling me sounds like he's got unstable angina. I asked her if you were having chest pain at this time. She said no. So I said, have him come in this afternoon. Well, 45 minutes later, you showed up in
my
office. And you told me a story that I didn't like to what I heard. You were having chest pain. You described it as a squeezing, a tightness, a pressure when you mowed your lawn, when you walked up a flight of stairs.
Right, when there was exertion, when I'd be out raking leaves or mowing the lawn.
You told me you saw a small branch off a tree, and you can hardly get through it because you had this pressure in your chest.
Right.
Well, I told you at that time that when people have chest pain, we can pretty quickly decide where it's going to go, whether it's not heart, it is the heart, or the big in between. We're not sure. They're the difficult ones. But with you, as soon as you started telling me the story, these light bulbs went in my head, and I said, I don't like what I'm hearing.
Because it was related to exertion?
Exertion and how often it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
If you told me it happened 6 months ago, 3 months ago, and it hadn't happened since, I may not have sent you to the hospital. But it was happening so frequently and more frequently that I thought this was what's called unstable angina.
Now, here's the funny thing. I mean, I'm a regular exerciser at the gym 3-4 times a week. I'd been on the Stairmaster that Saturday before I came in to see you. I look back now with some horror, thinking, my gosh, I could have, I don't know what to myself climbing that Stairmaster a couple of days before. Do people tend to know when they're in the channel towards some heart problem, or is it a mystery to them? I mean, on the one hand, I was concerned. On the other hand, I was still going to the gym.
Well, I think a lot of people don't know. They don't know what they're experiencing. And if they call the doctor, I guess we have to work it out together to figure out what the story you're telling and what it all means. If you're not sure, there's some tests we can do, and they're not so perfect, but we have to kind of take every symptom seriously and decide where to go from
there. EKG test didn't show a problem right there. You decided, do a stress test because...
I've already spoken with Rodney Fogg. I said if the stress test is negative, his story is so scary that we'd have had to consider it a false negative. And I told you before I sent you to the EKG that I want to make sure there's nothing happening right now.
Right.
And even if the EKG is going to be normal, you're going to the hospital.
Within a few minutes, they were loading me in the ambulance.
And you said, tally-ho, and there you went.
Tally-ho, and off to the hospital. When I got to the emergency room, Rodney Falk, within just a couple of minutes, I saw you there, Dr. Falk, cardiologist. This must be just a very regular part of your life. But here's one patient coming in, complaints of tightness in the chest. My primary care physician has sent me on. What's the decision tree you're looking at when you look at someone like I was sitting there?
Well, the answer is yes, it is common. But many people who come don't have cardiac discomfort, and many do. So the first thing that the cardiologist has to do is to decide whether this is true cardiac discomfort. You were easy. You had exertional chest discomfort. The pattern was a textbook pattern. And even though, as you point out, the electrocardiogram was normal, this was clearly somebody who needed further investigation to determine where the blockage was. And as I think I told you, there was a greater than 90% chance that you were going to have a blockage there.
Judging from my symptoms, judging from the story alone.
The story is critical in many things in medicine, and particularly so in cardiology.
Mm-hmm. It quickly came, you needed to find out more before you could decide what goes on, because these days there's plenty of bypass surgery, but there is a lot of putting in stents, these little, I don't know how you describe them, kind of braces that open up arteries that may be experiencing some clogging. Before we get to the surgery, there was the catheter the next day. They run up through the sort of top of my leg, put some dye in the heart, looked at what was going on there. And when you looked at that, what did you see that led you and the rest of the crew to say, well, maybe surgery is the thing, not just a stent or two?
Well, probably 2 out of 3 patients can get away with stenting of an artery under this circumstance. But in your case, you had a single blockage that involved a main coronary artery, the left anterior descending, and a very large branch of that. And it was very close to the origin. And after a lot of discussion...
It is high in this kind of flow.
High up where the artery starts.
Mm-hmm.
After a lot of discussion with the people in the catheterization lab, It was decided that while this could be stented, putting a stent in was probably not as good as going to bypass surgery because the risk of stenting was a little bit higher than the average blockage. And that's where the decision tree came along, and we said, go the route of bypass surgery.
Dr. Shekhar, you actually took me under the knife. When you opened me up and looked at that heart, what did you see? A mess of blockages or the single blockage that Dr. Falk's talking about?
No, we were just dealing with just the one blockage that Dr. Falk is talking about, and we found that your heart was otherwise in excellent shape. The function of the heart was not impaired at all. It's a normally functioning heart, and no evidence of any previous heart attack, so to speak. The thing about coronary bypass surgery is that the roadmap comes from the catheterization. So mm-hmm. we know
that is when they take the look, put in the dye, and then right. and then take a look.
Correct, and that tells you where the blockages are, and we confirm that by feeling that area. And if the roadmap tells you that there are no blockages elsewhere, and that is what we will go by. And we knew that you had a blockage involving two big arteries, and you needed a double bypass.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the wild ride I just had with heart bypass surgery and the latest news on heart disease and treatment in America. I'm joined this hour by a big piece of the terrific team that got me into the hospital and pulled me through very wonderfully, I must say, and I'm grateful to all of them. My primary care physician, Dr. Nahum Vishnevsky, with Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dr. Rodney Falk, cardiologist at Harvard Vanguard, who was there in the emergency room when I came in. The surgeon, Prem Shekhar, a cardiac surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital, is with us today, and Michelle DePreet, cardiac nurse at Brigham and Women's Hospital, who, along with many others, pulled me through on the other side. We've got a lot of people calling in with questions and observations. Let's get a call right away from Seattle, Washington. Dennis, you're on the air, Dennis.
Hello, Tom. Boy, I'm sure glad that you're doing okay.
I'm doing great, and I'm pretty darn glad myself about that.
Well, your program's timely because I spent Christmas Eve in an emergency room. I recently went through a divorce and moved and under a lot of personal pressures and had about 4 or 5 days of chest discomfort and went into the emergency room and they did electrocardiogram and blood tests and so forth and said, gee, it really doesn't appear to be any cardiac issues yet. I felt that tightness in the chest and fluttering in the chest, and it sounds like maybe I need to go a step further with your team of experts there. I was wondering what they think I should do next, because I'm still feeling that occasionally when I'm resting. I just got off the Nordic track for 45 minutes and worked up a sweat, no problems at all.
And yet, for you, and I'm sure many others, depending, that question can hover right there. Now, I know they'll say they can't make a real diagnosis from this distance and on such a quick summary, but let's just ask again, Dr. Vishnevsky, here you go. This is the kind of story many Americans have experienced. Dennis is in the midst of it right now. He's got a divorce. He's got a move. He's got life issues going on and chest pain. How do you sort out what you ship off in the ambulance and what you say, well, maybe not?
That's what makes it so difficult sometimes. Yeah. We're faced with this all the time. You have to listen to the symptoms. We ask a lot of questions around symptoms to try to decipher whether it could be the heart or not, and then decide if testing should be done. And maybe Dr. Falk can corroborate this, but I think of only about 5% of people who go to the emergency room who have chest pain actually have the heart problem. The national average, people who don't
in
have heart disease.
In other words, 95%, it turns out.
I'm not sure that's
a statistic,
very small percentage actually have heart disease, and mm-hmm. it's very difficult to figure it out. So that's when you have to put people through tests. Many factors could be the esophagus, could be heartburn, could be anxiety, the other gastrointestinal problems. That's what makes, especially being on the front lines, it makes it very difficult sometimes.
Rodney Falk, Dr. Falk, here's Dennis in Seattle. Chest pain, fluttering, stuff going on in life that's high pressure, you could say. Many people feel this one time or another. You're part of the crew that sorts it out. Talk to Dennis for a minute about his situation and this sorting that goes on.
Well, it's interesting because psychological stress can trigger cardiac symptoms in somebody who has cardiac problem. On the other hand, psychological stresses can mimic cardiac disease in somebody with a perfectly normal heart. So obviously one can't deal with this over a radio show for an individual, but psychological triggers can do this, and you can go on a treadmill and feel perfectly fine and yet have something going on. So probably follow up with your primary care doctor and see if further testing is recommended by him or her, was what the only thing I can say, I think, at the moment.
For Dennis, stay on top of it and stay well. We hope it comes out well on the other side. Let's get a call from Charlie in East Longmeadow, Massachusetts. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Tom. I'm glad you're a part of the Zipper Club now.
That's what they call it because of what? The scar up the chest, though. It doesn't look quite as zippery as it used to, maybe. Mine barely shows up 6 weeks after the surgery. But what do you know, Charlie?
Well, I know one thing. I had a heart attack. I was working out extremely hard. I didn't even know I had a heart attack. All I knew is I felt very, very tired. And I had an EKG, routine one, and they said something's not right, and that led to a further test. They said I had four arteries that were blocked in the high 90s. So I went to Brigham and Women.
Same hospital where I went for my surgery, yep, in Boston.
Oh, it's a super, super, super hospital, great care. I had a top surgeon, Sari Aranki.
Great.
I'm sure the people on your show know of him. And a great critical care from the nurses' teams. It was fantastic. It wasn't any fun recuperating and having those tubes taken out with the, you know,
the drainage tubes.
But I got through it, and I was determined to get back to the gym and do the cardio every day, and to hone in on my diet to make sure that I had as much good cholesterol, the HDL, in my body as possible. Got on more medicines and...
Charlie, I'm an inquiring mind who now has a personal interest in knowing how's your quality of life on the other side of all that. I had a double. You had a quadruple. How is it?
I would say it's much better. It's much better in the sense that if I didn't even have a heart attack, it's much better than that. So it's not that it's a death sentence. It is much better.
That's
great. My quality of life is better. I don't really think about it. I don't have any chest pain. I had what is called angina. Upon exertion, after 10 minutes, I would get this kind of a burning sensation. Sometimes I had a sense that I was having a lack of oxygen.
Mm.
Now I run on the treadmill. I don't get that. I lift weights vigorously. I don't get that. I just don't get it, you know?
I love it. I love your story, Charlie. I'm right behind you and intend to be right there. And thank you very much for calling. I want to come back to the surgery here, but I can't wait too much longer to get Michelle DePreet in here. She was one of the cardiac nurses at Brigham and Women's Hospital who helped me through. Same hospital you were at, Charlie. Michelle, you hear in Charlie's voice how much it matters, and I really didn't quite anticipate this. I mean, on the other side of the whole surgery, and we're going to talk about the details of that surgery, but on the other side of it, there you are with everybody else who picks a patient up and gets them through. I mean, when they first come out of the ICU into your world, these are people who have just been through some pretty major surgical operations. Do you find people, you know, bewildered, helpless when they first come into your care, Michelle? What kind of mood, attitude are people in?
Well, I think that, you know, patients we see, especially in your case, it's a shock. They had no symptoms. All of a sudden they have this, and then they're in the hospital.
I'm a big, strapping guy. I thought I was invincible.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that it's a course that occurs that you see with patients. You know, we see them on post-op day one. We see them at their worst, you know, fully lined with all of these tubes and lines.
Oh, boy, yes. There were lots.
No idea what's going on. And then it's great to see the progress that you make and to see that from day one to post-op day number three, you're feeling awful to you're walking around the pod, you're walking stairs, and you're preparing to go home. So I think that... You know, it's a process that we see with patients, and they're scared, and it's a whole new lifestyle for them. So,
you were absolutely great, as were many others. But I was so, I mean, it just seems like a miracle when people come in who are so attentive and competent, and I can't thank you enough for that. That care after the surgery, because it matters so much. I mean, the surgery on a Wednesday, just about this time of day, and Sunday, I was out of there, which seems like a miracle in itself. Walking, I mean, they make you get in the wheelchair, but, you know, I was out and walking that same day. Prem Shekhar, take us back to the surgery itself. I mean, we're talking about cutting open a person's chest here through the lining into the heart, kind of sealing the heart off, going on a heart-lung machine. In this case, the person is me. How exactly do you do that? You start by what, sort of cutting through the skin right down the middle of the chest, and then the saw comes out.
That is right. You know, this operation is done through an incision that runs up and down right in the front of your chest, mm-hmm. right in the middle, mm-hmm. and underneath that is your breastplate, what mm-hmm. we call the sternum. Mm-hmm. And the sternum also is divided vertically with the use of a saw, and that leads us directly onto your heart.
So you describe this a little bit to me. This is a saw. You kind of hook it in at the top of the sternum. It's an up and down motion, kind of like a skill saw.
That's right.
In a wood shop. I'm sure it's more sophisticated, but you saw right down through the sternum. Is that a big process? Is that 2 seconds? What's that like?
It takes us a very short period of time. It's usually done in about 10 or 15 seconds mm-hmm. because these are very sophisticated instruments. They work very well.
Now, when you saw that sternum in half, what does the chest do? Does it kind of pop open? Do the muscles pop it up? Or do you have to pry open the chest to get into the heart?
No, the chest remains closed because mm-hmm. it is held together not only by the breastplate but also by the ribs that lead onto the breastplate. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't spring open, so to speak. We do gently open it with the help of a retractor. So
I like that gentle word. But those are strong muscles in the rib cage and around there. I mean, don't you have to exert some force to open it up?
The muscles are not so much a problem because you're under a general anesthetic and you have a paralytic. So the muscles are all paralyzed and mm-hmm. They will not really give you that much resistance. But a lot of the resistance comes from the ribs because mm-hmm. these are fixed bony structures mm-hmm. and they don't like being moved around quickly.
And then you come to a kind of sac around the heart itself.
That is correct. So we first encounter the sac in which the heart is contained, which is called the pericardial sac, and mm-hmm. then we have to open the sac in order to get to your heart.
Now, now you've cut through the chest, you've cut through the sac, and you see the heart. It's
right.
Presumably working away there. It's beating. How do you start to handle it? I mean, you're going to go in and do some major operation on that
right.
rather important muscle.
I mean, the way we do it at the Brigham and Women's Hospital most of the time is by using the heart-lung machine. Mm-hmm. So we first start with the, you know, before all this happens, we, of course, have to first take out the conduit that we are going to use to construct the bypasses.
In other words, the other arteries or vessels from in this case, my body, that are going to give us the workaround.
Correct. The vessels from your body that are now going to be attached onto your heart to serve as the new arteries.
In a lot of cases, that's a vessel that will come from the leg because that's what's best and most available. In my case, you used mammary arteries. Men have them, don't necessarily need them in the same way women do, but how did you decide to use these arteries that were already in my chest rather than go to the leg?
Correct. The gold standard coronary bypass operation is with the use of the left internal mammary artery mm-hmm. and the use of a large vein in your leg that is called the saphenous vein. Mm-hmm. But we use other conduits as well, as in both mammary arteries, as we used in your case, and sometimes an artery from the forearm called the radial artery, and there are various other conduits that are available.
If you had all your options, why did you choose, in my case, to use both mammary arteries?
You're a young, otherwise fit, healthy adult male who's been struck by this disease mm-hmm. In the prime of his life, and mm-hmm. We know from data that arterial conduits last longer than the veins in your legs. So in order to get you the best outcome mm-hmm. for the future, I chose to use two arterial bypasses, and these are the two best ones.
So these are long-lasting. I'm happy to hear that. Long may they reign. And what, you pull at one end of each of these arteries over to the heart? I always pictured it as a sort of a literal sort of U that you'd make kind of like a highway bypass right over a blockage. But in fact, it's a bit different than that.
Well, what is traditionally done is that little U that you speak about, where one end of the conduit is connected to the big artery that comes out of your heart, the aorta, and the other end of the conduit is connected to the coronary artery that is blocked.
Mm-hmm.
But in your case, we used the mammary arteries that are still attached at the top mm-hmm. to where they were originally attached, but at the bottom they were disconnected and attached onto your heart. They are routed in such a fashion that they will, without any bends and kinks, will reach to the point on your heart where they need to reach. So,
Dr. Rodney Falk, I found myself amazed in all this by the adaptability, what feels like the adaptability of the body. I mean, you can kind of reroute the flow here, and the heart and circulatory system just say, okay, fine, great, well, we can do that.
Well, perhaps not quite so simple. I'm not sure. I can do that. Prem can do that, but... There is a certain adaptability, this is really a technique that has developed over the years through the use of clinical trials to develop that indicate that it is effective. And as most of our treatments now, we really focus on things that have been proven. So we wouldn't know that the mammary arteries worked better than vein grafts if we didn't have years of experience and years of people looking at it and see which is better. So this has been a very slow process over 20, 30 or more years to really determine that this works.
But we should say, for many people, that using both mammary arteries is not an option. If you're older or overweight or have diabetes, it's not necessarily an option.
Correct. The person that is least likely to, I mean, the person in whom we are least likely to use two mammaries is a older, insulin-dependent, overweight, diabetic female.
It just can't happen there. We have so many callers who want to join us. Let me go to Brian, calling from Bozeman, Montana. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Enjoy your show. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a stent put in Germany when I was in the service. I was on Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2004. I was almost 58 when I had it. And my symptoms was that it was felt like it had what we joked as petrified fish in a mess hall the night before, and I thought I had like a fish bone caught. And ended up being medevac. My medic made me go to the on my aircraft, made me go to see the clinic, and ended up next day they did a enzyme test on my blood and sent me to Lundstedt and had a stent put in one blocked artery.
Wow, Brian, this is incredibly contemporary story. So you were 58 in the U.S. military in Iraq, weren't feeling good, and end up medevaced. This is a whole new kind of image of the American military man. But medevaced out of military theater to Germany and had a stent put in. You got a question out of that?
Yes, actually, I have two questions. One is the restenosis. I want to know what for both open heart surgery where you have the new arteries replaced,
yep,
and also where you have a stent. What is the likelihood of the blockage recurring due to scarring tissue? And then the second question is as far as the procedure, why the blockage occurs just on one or two arteries?
Both great questions. Rodney Falk, we just got a half minute before the break, but the risk of recurring, and why just one or two?
The risk of recurring, or the medical term of restenosis, that is reblockage within a stent, somewhat dependent on the type of stent, whether it has a drug in it or not. It's probably in the region of 10 to 15% if it's a metal stent, and if it's got drug eluting, it's less than that. But this doesn't necessarily lead to a heart attack. It's more a nuisance phenomenon. Why it occurs, where it occurs, coronary disease is a general disease.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the wild ride I just had with heart bypass surgery, the latest news on heart disease and treatment in this country. I've got three doctors with me and a cardiac nurse who just pulled me through, maybe saved my life at an 80% blockage in one place. It's fixed, thank heavens, but it's never quite over, as Dr. Rodney Falk, the cardiologist with us today, was just saying. We'll look at that. My primary care physician, Nahum Vyshnevsky, is with us with Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, the guy who sent me to the hospital, got me on the track, Prem Shekhar. Dr. Shekhar is with here, the surgeon who put me under the knife and brought me through what looks like very well indeed, and Michelle Dupreet, just one of the many wonderful nurses who helped on the other side. And Joan is calling from Simsbury, Connecticut. Hi, Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Good to have you.
I wanted to bring up women My mother had a heart attack last Christmas, and she really did everything right. She started having discomfort, burning sensations, pains, went to her primary care physician. They thought it was acid reflux, and this went on for several weeks until she drove herself to the emergency room, and they rushed her to Yale for open heart surgery.
Wow. Your mother and mine some years ago, had bypass surgery. Dr. Falk, what about women and heart disease, symptoms, and the rest? Do women present differently from men when it comes to heart problems? And what do you think of Joan's story?
It's an interesting and unfortunately not unusual story. Women may present differently, but it's important to know that as women age, although they have less heart disease when they're younger, they catch up in terms of coronary heart disease. And it turns out that a higher percentage of women actually die of heart attacks and cardiac disease than do men. So for some reason, physicians may not think of coronary disease in a woman. And yet here were symptoms that are suggestive. Again, I can't tell you precisely why there was a delay in diagnosis, but unfortunately it did occur. It also occurs in men, the delay, but I'm pleased to hear that in the end that everything came out fine.
Dr. Wisniewski, maybe you may see mainly men as a male primary care physician, but in your experience, is it harder to sort it out if it's a woman, or you just have to know the symptoms?
Well, I think there's a natural bias to think that women are at a lower risk, but as Dr. Falk said, as they get older, they catch up to men. And it's well known through some studies that the symptoms that women have with coronary artery disease are sometimes a little more ambiguous, not so clearly defined. So we have to think a little bit harder when a woman has chest pains, but...
And Michelle DePreet, when you're in the hospital and dealing with patients on the other side of heart surgery, do you see other generalizable differences between the way men and women tend to deal with it? Joan's mom had issues. My mom had bypass surgery. What do you see gender differences, Michelle?
I think post-op, I think it's the generalized patients feel the same way. They're having pain issues is the same. It's the general same care post-op. I don't think that we see. We do see the patients in their histories, because we don't see them a lot of times before surgery, but we do see in their histories that sometimes women do have different symptoms that cause them to come in.
It's not exactly a routine without its discomfort. Who deals better with the discomfort on the other side, post-op, Michelle, men or women? Or do you see a difference?
The biggest difference we see is usually younger patients have a lot more pain. We find that versus men versus women, we find that the younger patient with more muscles and the chest have more pain. That's something that typically we see.
I had a little bout of that. Rodney Falk, you were there. In the ICU, I was flopping like a fish and really in pain for a little while when I kind of first came out of the surgery and stood up. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a painful procedure. We do try to control the pain, and as Michelle said, that it does vary from person to person. I think I indicated to you at the time that now you can tell your wife, you know what childbirth feels like.
Yeah, I think you said the younger and stronger a patient is, the more likely they are to feel that pain. Why is that?
I'm not even certain why that is, but maybe the older person is more attuned to discomfort and we're just wimps. I don't know.
Oh, boy. You had me going there for a while. I was really up and down. But thank heavens, the nurse pulled me right through that, and I'm grateful for that. Let's get a call from Marion in Hartford, Connecticut. Marion, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, I'm great, thanks, and very, very happy to report it.
Well, that's good. I was calling in because I experienced a double bypass when I was just turned 54, actually just before I turned 54. And as we've just discussed, I did not have chest pains at all. I think over maybe several months before, I had some back pains, but just aches and pains, but had gone to the doctor and really didn't come away with anything that would suggest problems with my heart. But on a weekend, I did experience some numbness in both of my arms, and I had my husband take me to the emergency room where they discovered that I had some blockages that could not be taken care of with a stent, but so they had to do the bypass. So my theory is that everyone needs to understand and know their body and understand what's right with them and what's not right with them. And I guess I do have a question for the physicians who are there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's related to the medications and diet. I mean, I've always had a healthy diet, eating a vegetarian at one point and then just not eating a lot of meats and fatty foods or fried foods. But I know that diet's important in terms of helping to keep the cholesterol in check, and medications are appropriate as well. But the question I have relates to how can we ever, get away from taking the medication? Is there any study that says that with a proper diet, proper exercise, that we can actually move away from medication?
Yeah, well, we'll look at that. I'll go to Dr. Falk on medication. Let's start with diet and maybe other risk factors. Dr. Wisniewski, when you speak with a patient, I mean, in my case, you've seen me for a long time. You know, what do you look for to the extent that you can sort out people's intakes, whether diet or smoking?
Well, you know, I think it's called primary prevention. With you, it was unexpected because you had no risk factors. You didn't have a high blood pressure, which is a risk factor, diabetes, you're not overweight, you never smoked. So I think in trying to prevent heart disease.
In fairness, I smoked until maybe 20 years ago a little bit. So does that matter, 20 years on?
I don't know that. I don't know if that really makes any difference now, but perhaps. But I think primary prevention is if you smoke, stop. If you're overweight, lose weight, exercise. If you have a diet that's very high in saturated fats, improve it. And if you eat red meat, minimize it. Exercise. If you have diabetes, manage it. If you have high blood pressure, get it treated. That's primary prevention. You can't do anything about your past history or your family history, but you can do a lot to try to improve your lot by minimizing your risks.
And Rodney Falk, what about the fact, as you've pointed out to me very clearly, this is not a one-time event. This is a condition. It's just a fact. So our caller's saying, well, what about medication? How do you treat the ongoing fact of heart disease? How much is lifestyle? How much is, I don't know, whether it's Lipitor or some other statins to control cholesterol and the rest?
Medications are really important. Certainly in combination with diet and exercise, but somebody, a woman at the age of 54 who's already had bypass surgery has got fairly extensive coronary disease, not just where the blockage was. And these medications get the cholesterol level down to a level that is far below we can do with diet. It's at a level that you don't see in Western society. You have to go to the sub-Saharan Africa and look at some of these African tribes out there who have very, very low cholesterol levels. So unfortunately, I think you're stuck with it if you want to have a healthy life. And of course, if you were a cigarette smoker, and that is the commonest cause of coronary disease in women of your age, that is absolutely critical to stop, both after surgery and at any time, in order to avoid coronary disease.
Well, that piece at least is as black and white as you can get. Let's get a call from Rob in Amherst, Massachusetts. Rob, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
I am a home care nurse. I listen to your show off and on as I go from house to house.
Yeah.
I am one of the many people who greet people home after that curious little twinge they feel. Next thing they know, they've had their chest opened and they're back at home after the whirlwind.
I remember it well.
Yes, indeed. So my thinking often is acknowledgement of the sort of technological marvel that this is.
No kidding.
And with great gratitude, I'm sure, by many. But also the ethical question that comes along with that. All your guests there and so many of us out here in the profession can give thanks for the job security that we have due to heart disease in this country. But I'd be curious to know whether any of your physicians there or for a later show, what is the cost from the moment someone steps in the ambulance to the moment my last visit as a home care nurse
I'm sure it's enormous, but what are you suggesting, Rob, that I should have just waited for a heart attack?
No, indeed, sir. But as with the last point being made, we're all very unaware of choices that we make, or in some cases are unable to avoid. Many people just have such a high risk. But it's just a curious thought. What is it that we spend? Because we all contribute.
Oh, yeah, no question. And when we gobble down those cookies and eggnog, we're part of it. On the other hand, in a case like mine, I didn't appear to be at such high risk. But, Rodney Falk, it's got to be very expensive, that trip that Bob's talking about from start to finish.
It is expensive. Maybe Prem knows better than I do. But unfortunately, once you've reached that stage, you're going to incur expenses. And I think that the point that Nachum has made of primary care prevention, if you want to reduce the expense, we've got to start in our 20s. We've got to stop eating fast food. We've got to stop smoking. And then you'll cut down on these expensive procedures later on.
Let me get a little bit of a bigger national picture for just a second here. Joining us right now from Framingham, Massachusetts, is Daniel Levy. He's director of the Framingham Heart Study at the National Institute of Health. Big, famous study, has followed thousands of people since 1948, one of the largest, longest-running, most important observational medical studies in the world. Daniel Levy, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Happy and healthy New Year to you.
Same to you, sir. What direction are we going as a country when it comes to heart disease, good, bad, or flat?
For the most part, very good. From the late 1940s to the present time, death rates from heart disease have declined by about 70%. And for most of the risk factors that contribute to heart disease, things like cigarette smoking, high cholesterol levels, high blood pressure, they're all moving in the right direction. The thing that's moving in the wrong direction is the national epidemic of obesity, and it's dragging with it increased rates of diabetes. We have to recognize that diabetes is yet another important risk factor for the development of cardiovascular disease.
And yet, heart disease still the leading cause of death, ahead of cancer, stroke, respiratory disease, all the rest. So it's kind of a race between what somewhat better lifestyle choices on the one hand, but still obesity on the other.
Yeah, in the last 40 years, heart disease death rates have declined by 70%. That decline may be threatened by the increase in obesity that we're seeing. Our children may be at greater risk for the development of this disease, paradoxically, than we are today, simply because of the rise in obesity.
Dr. Shekhar, you know, I'm in here and so grateful to be now on the other side of this. I know it wasn't cheap. I promise to make the right lifestyle choices going forward. What about some of the more, secondary or subtle effects here? You know, I've got to be on the air and at the job every day now and delighted to be. Many other people come back. The heart's a piece of this. What about the mind? Does the mind get involved in this? Do people come back with the same cognitive capacity they had before heart surgery?
There is a great apprehension about heart surgery and what we call neurocognitive dysfunction that is supposed to happen after heart surgery, but we don't see it as often as we used to at one point in time.
Because
most of this neurocognitive dysfunction supposedly comes from the use of artificial circulation from the heart-lung machine. Mm-hmm. And as technology has evolved, so also has the heart-lung machine. And today, the heart-lung machine is extraordinarily safe, and the incidence of neurocognitive dysfunction is extremely small. And we operate on a whole host of people. We operate on physicians, surgeons, radio talk show hosts, and a whole variety of people. And I'm happy to report that a lot of these people do go back to their lines of work and continue to do a tremendous job like they have always done. So I think the apprehension is valid because it does exist, but I think the percentage of people having serious neurocognitive dysfunction in the form of loss of memory, concentration, et cetera, is probably less than 2 or 3%.
And what about physically? When do you get back at it? You've seen my X-rays. You're my doctor here. But how long after bypass surgery till someone can be sort of completely physically back in the swim of life? Or do you ever get to go back to everything you did before?
Well, the entire purpose of this whole exercise is to get you back to your original lifestyle and more.
You told me I could be climbing mountains in 3 months. You standing by that?
Absolutely. And it takes about at least 6 weeks before the major aches and pains have gone away and you begin to start to feel better. And at about that time, we usually encourage people to start driving and go back to work if their job does not entail a lot of physical labor. But it's about 3 months by the time they could really go back to 100% of all they used to do before, including hard physical labor. So we don't keep people out of physical activity.
Well, I seem to be just about on that timetable and so grateful for it. Michelle DePreet, cardiac nurse at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Our time grows short here. Michelle, I just can't thank you and others there enough for all the such attentive care on the backside of this surgery. It meant more than I ever imagined going in. Not that I imagined going in at all, but I'm really grateful to you and to everybody there on the nursing side. Thank you very much. You were hugely important to me, and I really appreciated all your care and competence. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Tom.
And to the doctors sitting right here with me at the table, and to all our listeners out there who may have their own experience. Well, first to the doctors, Dr. Rodney Falk with Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates and Nahum Vishnevsky, who got me in there off the table into the hospital. I'm very grateful to both of you. And Prem Shekhar with Brigham and Women's Hospital, who put me under the knife. Thanks for your skill and attention, everything you brought to it. What an experience. I never expected it, but I'm glad to be on this side. Thank you to you all. Thanks for being here today.
Welcome, Tom.
My pleasure, Tom. And
and off we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.